Not all meals are created equal. For instance, breakfast has the spicy egg McMuffin for a limited time, and lunch doesn't. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At Designer Shoe Warehouse, we believe that shoes are an important part of, well,
everything. From first steps to first dates, from all-nighters to all-time personal bests.
From building pillow forts to building a life.
For all the big and small moments that make up your whole world, DSW is there. And we've got just the shoes. Find a shoe for every you from brands you love at brag-worthy prices at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Hey, you know how Black Friday sales are the best savings of the year? Well, what if we told you Wayfair's bringing Black Friday to July? That's right. Wayfair's biggest sale of the season is Black Friday in July. And it's on its way. Starting July 24th, score up to 80% off everything home at Wayfair. Snag outdoor furniture and decor at up to 60% off. Get area rugs for every room at up to 80% off. And refresh your sleep space with up to 60% off bedroom furniture. Plus, way more doorbuster deals on top products and 24-hour surprise flash deals. Oh, and did we mention free shipping on everything? Everything. These are Wayfair's lowest prices of the summer and the best time to make your home even more you. But it only lasts 5 days, so don't miss out. Mark your calendars, then head to Wayfair for up to 80% off Wayfair's biggest sale of the summer. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday and July sale, July 24th through 28th, only at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Get ready. Wayfair's biggest sale of the season is almost here. It's Black Friday in July, and it's coming your way. For 5 days only, score up to 80% off everything home at Wayfair. Plus amazing doorbuster deals and free shipping on everything. Yes, everything right to your door. So mark your calendars. Wayfair's Black Friday in July sale starts July 24th. Shop everything home at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
We're going to take a deeper dive in this episode into the traits that Karen Reed has exhibited in interviews, in writing, in basically public appearances in general. All over the place. We're going to be taking a look at many of them, put them together, and take a look at the psychology of it. Now, I'm not a doctor. I cannot diagnose anything, and I am not diagnosing anything of Karen Reed. I can't. But we can talk about behaviors. We can talk about patterns of behavior that we see and what it relates to, and how we describe those types of behaviors or those types of trends. And ultimately, it's up for a doctor to make any sort of diagnosis. And at the end of the day, words are words. What we're talking about more so is a way of operating, a way of thinking that certain people have. And a lot of them feels like they all went to the same convention one day and came back and said, this is how we're going to handle everything. And they're kind of predictable once you get to know them, once you understand what narcissistic thinking is all about. Now, I know it's a way of reused term. And there's, of course, everybody has a bit of it in them. Some people go way far. And then you get to another level where, and that's where diagnoses come in, where there's things called narcissistic personality disorder. Again, I'm not saying she has this by any means. That it would be for someone to diagnose a doctor, which I am not. But the behavior that we've been seeing, when you put it all together and you understand the dynamics of a relationship, if you were to be in one, and I'm not saying this was this, but the dynamics of a narcissistic abusive relationship, it's not good. I've been in several myself. And you're walking out the empathic person going, what the hell just happened here? Or sometimes you don't walk out at all. Again, not saying in any way that this is what that relationship was like. I'm just going to describe to you what we know about the case. And you can connect the dots as you will. Some will agree, some will disagree. This is just this man's opinion. So let's start at the beginning. People may be wondering why the banner over here says Karen Reed and her flying monkeys. Well, that is a term that is very much used in that arena. And if you have been in that arena, you may be familiar. It does make sense. And yes, it does reference The Wizard of Oz. It doesn't literally mean she has flying monkeys. Although, wouldn't that be exciting if she came into court every day and there was like literally flying monkeys right behind it? Hey, like that would be worth watching. That really would be. So let's get into the story. It all started the moment first responders arrived at the snowy Canton property in the early morning hours of January 29th in 2022. Karen Reed was visibly shaken. She was pacing the scene, repeatedly saying, "I hit him, I hit him, I hit him." As her boyfriend, Boston police officer John O'Keefe, lied lifelessly nearby. Let me go pause for a second. I do not know the tone in which she said that. So before anybody's like, "That wasn't the tone," you're right. I don't know. I'm going to guess it was every tone. I'm going to guess there was tones of, "I hit him, I hit him, I hit him." I'm going to guess you had all of it going on. That's my guess. I do not know the answer to that. But it was spoken many a times. And yes, did I was in front of some of those as well. Her boyfriend, Boston police officer John O'Keefe, was lying lifeless nearby. Those words echoed clearly in the ears of witnesses. Spontaneous admission, maybe, one that would seem nearly impossible to retract, yet almost immediately Reed's narrative began to shift dramatically, moving away from total initial frantic admissions into something far more complex, and some may view as self-serving. To really grasp what followed, it helps to understand how clinical psychology defines certain narcissistic behaviors. According to the DSM-5, narcissists often refuse accountability at all costs. They're quick to blame others, consistently portraying themselves as victims, and rarely express genuine empathy or remorse. There's even an acronym for one of the hallmark tactics, DARVO: deny, attack, reverse victim, and offender. It's a way of flipping reality on its head, making the person accused appear like the one who's been wronged all along. As we dig into Karen Reed's reactions and statements in the aftermath of John O'Keefe's death, I'll let you draw your own conclusions. I know what I drew, but again, not a doctor. Not saying she's this. Just saying, this is what this is called. Here's the sort of traits that have been, that would be demonstrated for that. And here's what happened. After those initial panicked confessions at the scene, Reed's public stance transformed very quickly. Instead of confronting what she initially expressed as, you know, tragic guilt and responsibility, she rapidly pivoted to full-blown denial. Court records documented this evolution clearly. Gone was any acknowledgement of even accidental culpability, replaced with a theory alleging that the true killers were inside the house. John had intended to visit that night. His friends, colleagues, fellow police officers, Reed claimed, in no uncertain terms, that she'd been framed by these people in a sinister plot designed to protect their own. The story morphed from a tragic accident to a complex conspiracy involving multiple law enforcement officers allegedly covering up a deadly assault. I mean, think about that pivot for a second. Imagine accidentally dropping your friend's favorite vase at their party. A straightforward reaction would be apologizing immediately, maybe even offering to replace it. But imagine instead, you immediately blamed other guests, accusing them of secretly conspiring against you, claiming they framed you because they never liked you. That's exactly the kind of blame-shifting scenario that we're seeing here, just multiplied by a factor of life and death. In the months that followed, Reed went public loudly and clearly, doubling down on her victim narrative. She stepped into the national spotlight, noticeably in a high-profile interview with ABC's 2020. Instead of expressing sorrow, regret, or even basic empathy for O'Keefe's grieving family, Reed repeatedly emphasized her own suffering. She portrayed herself as a targeted victim of police corruption, claiming, "I'm being set up, they're covering something up, and I'm the one paying the price." She leaned heavily into the role of a persecuted classic, a persecuted person, which is, again, a classic narcissistic posture where personal accountability is replaced entirely by indignation and self-pity. Again, not saying that she's that, just connecting dots, at least how they connect in my mind. Again, you may completely disagree, and I would love to hear how they connect otherwise. This complete reversal from immediate self-incrimination to aggressively claiming innocence, I mean, it fits precisely into the narcissistic tactic of Darvo. First, the denial. Reed publicly insisted she didn't harm O'Keefe, contradicting what she herself had spontaneously admitted at the scene. Second, the attack. Her legal team and media allies went after the credibility of investigating officers, accusing them of mishandling and manipulating evidence to incriminate her. And finally, the reversal. She portrayed herself as the real victim of a law enforcement conspiracy, suggesting that the actual culprits were the very individuals tasked with solving the crime. Again, that's how it looked. The lack of empathy she exhibited towards O'Keefe's family also stood out starkly. There was no attempt at reconciliation, allegedly, or as far as we know. Privately expressing condolences, court documents from the O'Keefe's family wrongful death lawsuit outline an entirely different story. The family alleged that Reed's action caused significant emotional distress, citing not only the tragedy itself, but her ongoing refusal to accept even the slightest bit of responsibility. The lawsuit detailed how Reed reportedly visited the family's home the morning after John's death, appearing concerned yet quietly orchestrating retrieval of her damaged Lexus, possibly removing evidence while the family remained in shock and grief. Who knows? It's an unsettling allegation, but one that underscores a troubling emotional detachment. I think we all saw that emotional detachment in that Investigation Discovery special, but we'll get to more of that in a little bit. For context, consider how most people respond after unintentionally harming someone that they care about. There's typically an immediate effort to make amends, show remorse, or at the very least acknowledge the pain that was caused. Yet, through public statements, interviews, and extensive court hearings, Reed maintained a conspicuously detached, defensive stance. When asked directly in media appearances about John's loss or the impact on his family, her answers reliably circled back to her own perceived injustice. I can't say at any point I personally saw her publicly demonstrate heartfelt sorrow for O'Keefe himself, other than that initial night where you see her in the video and losing it. After that, it's pretty much been Karen show, at least from my perspective. Her narrative consistently revolved around how she'd been wronged, how her life had been turned upside down, and I'm sure it was. That's the thing with all this. There's always pieces of reality that are in here. It's what you do with those pieces of reality that matters, and how it can either do good or harm yourself and a lot of others. Perhaps the most telling moment came in Reed's choice to defy normal courtroom decorum during her initial trial proceedings. Despite warnings and a clear gag order from the judge, she gave media interviews boldly asserting, "This is my testimony." Legal analysts described her actions as almost unprecedented for someone facing such severe charges, an enormous risk to say the least. But for Reed, controlling the narrative seemed to outweigh the legal dangers. In her own mind, it seemed she needed the world to view her exactly as she portrayed herself, an innocent victim heroically battling a corrupt system determined to destroy her. And it's tempting to dismiss all this as just an unusually aggressive defense strategy, but the psychological parallels to the word, the narcissism word, are very compelling. Again, not saying she is. I can't do that. So, again, a lot of parallels, though. Narcissists, they crave control, attention, and validation, often above any other priority. And when I mean any other priority, I mean any other priority. Anything. Their kids. Their family. Anything. Any other priority. I've seen it. Spooky. Including truth or genuine relationships, and Karen Reed's very public campaign to shift blame onto everyone else but herself, well, it aligns now, doesn't it? From the start, she seemed to view accountability, at least from many people's perspectives, as something other people owed her, never something she owed others. A deeply embedded unwillingness to face responsibility laid the groundwork for everything that followed, setting a chain of reactions and accusations, attacks, and media spin. Her calculated posturing as a victim not only muddled public perception, but effectively weaponized her growing group of vocal supporters, who would soon amplify her version of events far beyond her direct reach. As we dive deeper into this case, you'll see exactly how Karen Reed's initial reactions that may be viewed as narcissistic, her denial, blame shifting, and self-victimization didn't just shape the public narrative. They set in motion an aggressive network of individuals who'd come to her defense, enthusiastically doing her bidding, often without realizing they were serving someone else's psychological needs. The stage was set, and Reed's next move going to pull her even darker down the road and find more players into the story, already spiraling far beyond the original tragedy. If you've ever seen The Wizard of Oz, you'll remember those creepy winged monkeys blindly doing the Wicked Witch's dirty work without ever questioning her commands. In psychology, there's an actual term borrowed from those characters: flying monkeys. It refers to individuals who unknowingly become aggressive defenders of a narcissist, attacking perceived enemies, spreading narratives, and ultimately doing things the narcissist can't or won't do themselves. They're recruited through emotional manipulation, convinced they're fighting for truth and justice, and rarely see how they're being used to further someone else's hidden agenda. In Karen Reed's case, as her narrative of victimhood gained traction, a surprising and vocal group of supporters emerged. And in some ways, becoming her real-life flying monkeys. At the heart of this network was the blogger, Kearney. He's a controversial figure, even beyond this case, known around Massachusetts for aggressive online tactics, taking on local controversies, and not being afraid to pick public fights. From the start, Kearney became Reed's loudest, most relentless supporter and advocate, promoting her narrative of innocence and conspiracy with a tireless intensity. But he wasn't just casually blogging about the case. He became deeply invested, organizing rallies, public protests, and engaging daily with thousands of followers online. There's nothing wrong with doing just that. But soon enough, his involvement went beyond advocacy. According to public court documents, prosecutors have explicitly tied Kearney's activities to alleged criminal charges, alleged witness intimidation, alleged conspiracy, and alleged harassment, allegedly because of the aggressive way he pursued Karen Reed's defense in public. You might wonder how someone like this could become so passionately involved in such a complicated and messy case. It goes back to that concept of the flying monkeys. These types of people don't just recruit random people. They carefully frame their narratives to appeal deeply to their chosen allies and their sense of justice and righteousness. For Kearney, who already saw himself as something of a, I would say probably anti-establishment figure, at least that's what I would guess. Reed's claim of being victimized by police corruption and a systematic conspiracy fit his existing worldview perfectly. Karen Reed's portrayal as a helpless victim provided the perfect emotional fuel, establishing him and others to launch what they believed was a righteous crusade on her behalf. And the methods, they were controversial. On his blog and other social platforms, he allegedly openly identified and targeted anyone believed to oppose Karen Reed's narrative. And it wasn't subtle. He publicly exposed personal details, allegedly, a practice commonly known as doxing of police officers, witnesses, prosecutors. On the court steps, we saw the family of John O'Keefe getting booed by his people. The parents of the victim. Remember, the victim is John O'Keefe, not Karen Reed? Sometimes it takes a second. Like, the victim, Karen, like, no. Gotta rewind. He named many people, published their photos, places of employment, even addresses in some cases, making sure that they knew they were being watched and judged, which can get dangerous when you have crazy people involved. Because you don't know who's out there listening to that show and taking it even more seriously. In July of 2023, this aggressive advocacy, and I say advocacy in air quotes, spilled dramatically into the real world. He organized a rolling protest through the usually quiet streets of Canton, Massachusetts. Dozens of cars decked out with signs demanding justice for Karen Reed rolled slowly past homes and workplaces of witnesses and investigators connected to the case. Participants used bullhorns to shout accusations at those inside their homes, accusing them of involvement in an imaginary cover-up, warning them publicly that the truth would emerge. It was a tactic designed not just to support Reed, but to intimidate those who opposed her version of events. Her version of events. Exactly the kind of aggressive defense that characterizes flying monkeys in action. These, if you're going for flying monkey awards, they would get it. They were, my God, one of the most extreme version of flying monkeys I've ever seen. So I guess A for effort, but at the end of the day, did you really know what you were doing? You thought you knew your version of the truth, but then I don't know. The fallout wasn't just contained to demonstrations and online campaigns. O'Keefe's family, already was shattered by grief, found themselves subjected to a barrage of hostility as well. Family members described intense emotional distress in their wrongful death lawsuit against Karen Reed, especially highlighting these tactics as deeply traumatizing. According to documented court filings, the O'Keefe family endured persistent online harassment, and family members accused openly of lying, profiteering, and conspiring against Reed. Imagine losing someone you love violently and unexpectedly and then being accused publicly of covering up their murder. That's what the O'Keefes have publicly stated, that they experienced at the hands of some of Reed's most passionate defenders. Prosecutors weren't blind to these tactics either. They clearly saw the dangers inherent in the harassment campaigns, noting explicitly in court filings that Blogger Boy's online and offline records could interfere with witnesses and damage the integrity of the judicial process. They detailed these allegations formally, laying out the extensive online bullying, intimidation, and efforts to silence anyone who disagreed with Reed's innocence claims. wasn't a vague concern. It was detailed, specific, and fully documented. In fact, the aggressive advocacy became so intense and disruptive that the court eventually intervened, creating a special buffer zone around the courthouse entrances to protect jurors and witnesses from being intimidated or influenced or harassed. Imagine that, a murder trial needing buffer zones. Not just from curious onlookers, but from passionate, angry supporters mobilized by a blogger. Oh, Reed herself never publicly directed anyone to act in these aggressive ways, as far as we know. Prosecutors highlighted communications between her and Kearney as significant enough to include in their official motions. And according to court documents, prosecutors sought to introduce evidence of text exchanges and other communications between Reed and Kearney, aiming to establish a direct factual connection between her personal narrative and his subsequent aggressive advocacy tactics. Though she didn't explicitly tell Kearney or other supporters to harass witnesses or target the victim's family, prosecutors alleged that her carefully crafted public claims about police corruption and conspiracy served as a direct influence on those who did. What's especially compelling and unsettling about Flying Monkeys is their sincerity. Most of these individuals genuinely believe they're fighting for justice. They don't perceive themselves as bullies or harassers. They see themselves as truth seekers, heroes even, courageously speaking truth to power. Kearney, for instance, often framed his activities as journalistic free speech, a noble attempt to expose corruption and injustice. And many followers believed him completely. He also calls himself Journalism Jesus as well, for those followers that believe him completely. The more intense the allegation, the deeper their commitment grew, creating a cycle of ever-escalating advocacy. In psychological terms, narcissists leverage this sincerity by positioning themselves as the ultimate victims. This narrative of victimhood resonates powerfully, creating intense emotional identification among their supporters. Those supporters then willingly fight battles for the narcissist, never fully recognizing they're being manipulated into action. They become proxies, performing roles the narcissist either can't risk or doesn't want to be directly associated with, thus allowing them to maintain a public image of innocence or martyrdom. And so, in the real world, Karen Reed's Flying Monkeys, if you think of them as that, or they're just proud supporters out there that are doing their best to fight injustice, maybe they are. But in what appears to be this world, allegedly the Flying Monkeys are carrying out the narrative quite aggressively. They shouted her innocence from street corners and blogs, attacked critics, pressured witnesses, vilified grieving relatives, allegedly, all under the sincere belief that they were correcting a great wrong. These actions created chaos, confusion, very real emotional damage. It also muddled the waters of truth, complicating an already difficult legal process. But above all, it provided Karen Reed exactly what any person like her would hope for: a wall of devoted defenders committed wholeheartedly to a narrative she created and controlled. And again, just say allegedly to all of that. Can't diagnose anyone. Can't say that. So, have to be clear when we're using the term narcissist. I'm just putting it over here in this basket going, this is how this is defined. This is some examples of behavior. And here's some behavior that we've witnessed. Any questions? You can decide, because just because I'm saying this, or this is my opinion of the situation, doesn't mean it has to be yours. It's good to have a dialogue when it's civil and makes sense, of course. If you're just shouting things back and forth and calling names, then that's not a dialogue. Of course, behind all the noise and chaos, there was still a critical question. Why were so many ordinary people willing to become aggressive defenders of someone they didn't even know or barely knew? What was it about Karen Reed's narrative that made it so powerful, so believable, and so irresistibly compelling to her followers? As the court battles intensified and the prosecutors pushed back, they started examining not just the actions of these flying monkeys, but the narrative itself, looking closely at how it had managed to convince so many. And that narrative, the careful, strategic, relentless reshaping of reality, allegedly, would become central to the understanding exactly how a tragedy transformed into a divisive public spectacle, one powerful enough to draw in allies, launch protests, and turn a quiet Massachusetts town upside down. At its core, gaslighting is a psychological tactic designed to make people question their own perceptions and memories, to doubt what's real and what's not. It's not about simple disagreements or conflicting viewpoints. It's about deliberately rewriting the truth so convincingly and repeatedly that even rational people start second-guessing their own judgments. In narcissistic personalities, gaslighting is a common tool to maintain control, preserve self-image, and ensure others see the world exactly as they want it to be seen. Karen Reed's defense strategy became, consciously or not, a real-time study in how gaslighting can unfold in a public high-profile case. To understand how deeply this influenced the case, it's important to look closely at how the alternate cover-up narrative first appeared and evolved. Factual, documented events that shifted the entire course of the proceedings. The public first caught wind of a narrative shift through court affidavits filed by Reed's defense attorneys in early 2023. These weren't vague hints or subtle innuendos. They were explicit accusations against multiple law enforcement officers, alleging a conspiracy to frame Karen Reed and cover up the supposed real cause of John O'Keefe's death. Suddenly, the story went from a tragic late-night accident to a dramatic tale involving an assault inside the home John intended to have a drink at, and a deliberate effort by his friends, colleagues, and the police to protect their own at the expense of an innocent woman. It was as if the facts of the case had suddenly splintered, and everyone had to choose which reality to believe. And once a cover-up theory was introduced, every small detail of the original investigation became ammunition for confusion and doubt. For example, a seemingly bizarre 2:27 a.m. Google search, "How's long to die in cold?" from a witness's phone turned into a cornerstone of Reed's claims. Her team used a single puzzling piece of digital evidence to argue not just negligence, but criminal intent and conspiracy. Suddenly, minor forensic discrepancies, timing of a delayed 911 call, or even the severity of John's injuries, all previously understood as tragic circumstances, were reinterpreted as evidence of deception and foul play. With every court appearance, the defense systematically challenged established facts, openly accusing investigators of incompetence and misconduct. What had initially been straightforward forensic conclusions that John was struck by a vehicle and left outside in the freezing cold were now constantly portrayed as questionable, manipulated, or fabricated. And each time these allegations were aired publicly, onlookers grew increasingly uncertain. If experienced law enforcement officials who'd handled countless similar investigations could supposedly botch this one so badly, what else might have they have missed or hidden? This tactic wasn't limited to courtroom arguments. It spilled deliberately and continually into public statements and strategic media appearances. In her widely viewed interview on ABC's 2020, Karen Reed appeared poised, articulate, and unwaveringly confident. Her carefully delivered statements weren't merely defensive, they proactively attacked the credibility of investigators, openly accusing law enforcement officials of orchestrating a malicious frame-up. And by doing this, Reid directly challenged not just the prosecution's narrative, but the basic foundations of the public's trust in local authorities. And I'm going to say for good reason, too. I mean, look at the Sandra Birchmore case. So some of these make sense. But that's the thing. There's always nuggets of reality in this. These appearances multiplied. The ripple effects became increasingly pronounced. Social media exploded with theories, counter theories, heated debates. Was it really possible that a suburban police department could be involved in such a sweeping conspiracy? Or was Karen Reid spinning an elaborate story to avoid accountability? Suddenly, everyone's following the case felt compelled to question their own interpretations of reality. Facts seemed increasingly slippery. Truth became subjective. And what was once clear became frustratingly ambiguous. The confusion reached its pinnacle during Reid's first trial in mid-2024. Over two exhausting months, the jury listened to 74 witnesses sifting through endless layers of evidence, claims, and contradictions. But when deliberations began, it became obvious just how deeply the defense's gaslighting tactics had penetrated. According to documented court records, jurors became sharply divided, unable to confidentially agree on the basic facts of the case. Four jurors were ready to acquit Reid outright, influenced heavily by the defense's repeated and relentless claims of conspiracy and doubt. This deadlock wasn't merely about uncertainty over a few pieces of evidence. It reflected a profound, deliberate erosion of trust in the investigators, the prosecutors, and even eyewitnesses. And in the end, unable to find consensus, the jury declared they were hopelessly divided, forcing a mistrial. What had begun as a clear-cut criminal investigation devolved into a tangled mess of accusations and competing realities. Direct result of a calculated effort, it seems, to allegedly undermine basic trust in objective truths. The prosecution understood exactly what was happening. In response, they documented through official court filings a clear and detailed pattern of attempts by Reid's defense and supporters to allegedly distort facts and intimidate or discredit witnesses. They sought to introduce specific text messages, emails, and other communications into evidence, clearly hoping to establish a concrete link between Reid's public narrative and the active campaign to confuse, distract, and intimidate key witnesses, allegedly. Prosecutors explicitly argued that Reid's team deliberately blurred the lines between factual investigation and conspiratorial storytelling, and that these efforts significantly hindered the legal process. These legal battles didn't just affect the jurors. They created lasting fractures within the community itself. Trust in local law enforcement, typically stable and relatively strong in a suburban town like Canton, was shaken. Ordinary citizens watching coverage of the trial or reading passionate online debates began to openly question whether they could trust police, prosecutors, the courts. Parents, neighbors, local residents previously inclined to trust authorities or each other found themselves doubting who to believe, what to trust, and where to turn for unbiased information. And it wasn't just hypothetical. Public meetings became contentious, with community members demanding transparency and clarity from local officials. Conversations around the dinner table shifted from sadness about John's tragic death to arguments over who was lying, who was being deceived, and whether justice itself had become compromised. A once straightforward criminal case had been transformed into a community-wide debate over truth itself. In this context, the psychological tactic of gaslighting achieved its textbook objective. It forced rational people to doubt even the most basic understandings of reality. The sheer persistence and emotional power of the conspiracy narrative overshadowed simpler, less dramatic explanations, As prosecutors pointed out, no matter how concrete their forensic evidence appeared, the relentless assertions from Reed's camp made every fact suspect, every witness potentially compromised, and every official possibly corrupt. And this confusion wasn't accidental or coincidental. Gaslighting depends entirely on repetition and consistency. By repeating claims of conspiracy, corruption, and incompetence over and over, Reed's defense methodically replaced established facts with doubt and objective analysis with emotional uncertainty. Like the best practitioners of gaslighting, they never deviated from their chosen narrative, no matter how much objective evidence piled against it. Even though their narrative could change, which it did several times. I don't remember dropping him off. Last time I saw him was at the waterfall. I dropped him off, and then I left. Oh, I dropped him off. I sat there for 10 minutes, waiting for him to get into the house and come out. And then I just assumed that he was fine and safe, and I went home because I wasn't feeling good. Or everything was the same up until that, but the emotions are very different. It was, I was so pissed at him because he is probably a girl in there. It's something of that nature. As you listen to the voicemails, I'm going to go with the latter. I think it was more pissed than it was. Oh, he's safe. Let me go back home and watch Murder, She Wrote. Consistency and repetition are precisely what give gaslighting its insidious strength. Don't change the motive on everybody who's on your flying monkey team. But you can change your narrative all you want because they don't care anymore. They're so invested in you. It's what gives it its insidious strength. And the context of Karen Reed's defense, they were employed with remarkable effectiveness. If that's what was going on, allegedly. The tragedy at the heart of the case, John O'Keefe's sudden, violent death, gradually became secondary to the swirling questions. Competing accusations, public distrust, truth became not just difficult, but almost impossible to discern. And when the truth itself becomes negotiable, when reality feels subjective and debatable, the very foundations of justice begin to crumble. By systematically rewriting reality, Karen Reed's defense didn't just complicate a single trial. They reshaped the entire community's perception of truth and justice. Turn neighbors into adversaries, jurors into skeptics, and the courtroom itself into an arena where facts felt like opinions and justice felt very subjective. And in doing so, they illustrated perfectly just how powerful and dangerous narcissistic gaslighting campaigns can be, if that's what it was. Was that what it was? Those are definitions of what it is. These are stories of what happened. Does the definition, it's, you know, like you know, back in school where you had to like, okay, connect the word to that definition or that sort of thing. And you know what? All of our lines might not go to the same place. And that's fine. This is opinion. This is allegations. It's conjecture. You do your research, you make up your mind. From my perspective, this is the type of correlation I'm seeing. If you really want to get deep into it, do some research into surviving narcissistic relationships and people that are coming out of it, the type of person they are. It's usually a very empathetic person, a very giving person, a selfless person, the type of person who would take in his niece and nephew and try to be there for them when both their parents just died, the type of person who would be a police officer. Basically everything that John O'Keefe has been described to have been. And the person on the other side of that relationship, acting out the way that we see happening right here. Yeah, that fits a definition. Again, not a diagnosis, but it seems to fit a definition. But again, what do you think? Please, sane replies only. Not going to deal with any going off the rails, hate, or name calling. Serious conversation. What do you think? I'm very willing to hear it from any side. I've contemplated both sides, and I think the reality falls somewhere in the middle. If she is a narcissist, that doesn't make her a murderer. I think that's a very key thing to note here, too. My point on this was not in any way to say that, because I don't think that that makes her a murderer by any means. It's just identifying the patterns of behavior and how they're all very classic. Tell me what you think in the comments. Press subscribe wherever you're downloading podcast. I would very much appreciate that. And if you're listening to the podcast, check us out on YouTube. You can see all the stuff we're talking about and watch us on camera. And vice versa. You can take us anywhere you want with the podcast as well. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. My name is Tony Bruschi. I appreciate you listening and your support. Stay with us.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed, or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.